You may know that I teach a weekly Parsha class here at Ikar in Los Angeles every Thursday at noon, Pacific time. You're welcome. We've got folks joining us virtually from places as far away as Japan on Zoom. And we've been archiving video edits of the classes on YouTube, but we thought we might try cutting down the 1 hour class to about 40 minutes for you, for the listeners of the Best Book Ever podcasts that might not be able to fit a midday class on a Thursday into your schedule. So I hope you enjoy listening to these as much as I enjoy teaching them. If you're interested to attend the class from wherever you are in the world in person, then stick around at the end of the podcast. I'll tell you how to register. Just like the podcast, it's absolutely free, and we'd love to have you. All right. Welcome. Welcome to class. I'm so proud of myself for finding that song. Does how many of you remember the show Eight Is Enough? It's like only the older folks here are gonna raise their hand. Vera, who steers this ship, had never heard of it because she's too young. But I had to find a song with eight in it because that's actually what we're gonna be talking about today. Literally the number eight. I want to just admit that a little bit of a bias from the outset. Eight is actually my favorite number. You know how you're a kid and they like you want you're supposed to pick a favorite color and a favorite number. Eight has always been my favorite number, and that is partially because I was born in the 8th month, August, and on the 16th day. That's 2 times 8. I sort of noticed that, and I was like, oh, maybe I'm an eight, a child of eight. But it's also because, primarily because Gary Carter, who was a catcher for the Mets, was number eight when I was growing up. So that's actually like how I picked my favorite number. All of which is to say, I'm a little biased in designing a whole class around this, my favorite number. But really, this class is about numbers and how we analyze numbers in the Torah, how we look at numbers in the Torah, and whether numbers are nothing more than units of counting or measurement, or we can understand numbers to have a kind of symbolism. And I'm obviously going to argue for the latter, or there wouldn't be a class. So let's say a blessing, and then we'll take a look at the numbers, the many numbers that appear at the beginning of this week's Parsha, Parsha Tezria, and then we're going to focus on one in particular. So let's say a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidshanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu La'asok B'divrei Torah. Thank God for the tradition that allows us to gather in this way and think and study. The number eight. How do we get to the number eight? Well, before we get to the number eight, let's just talk about some of the big numbers in our tradition. It is actually not a stretch to say that numbers have symbolic meaning, and you know this because the big number in our tradition is the number seven, and in some ways that's part of what pushes the class to eight. I mean, it's very close. Seven, no question. We could give a whole year of classes on the number seven. The Torah starts with the number seven. The days of creation are divided into seven, and that seems to matter because the seven seems to be a special day. God rested on the seventh day. I probably don't have to say a lot about seven, but it sort of defines a It sort of a def like represents a paradigm for numbers that have greater that have repeating significance that come to mean something independent of their simple quantitative meaning. The number seven is forever associated with creation and with cycles of time, and so many of our cycles of time in this tradition are sevened, and not just Shabbat, but many of the holidays, and even the 7th month is the month that has a lot of our holidays. The 7th year is the year of the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, the 7 times 7 years. Anyway, that's the obvious one. And there are others, right? What are some other numbers that are big in this tradition? Let's put some into the chat. Those are some big numbers in this tradition. 36, 40, what else? Jubilee, 400 comes up a lot. I don't even know if Noah meant to type 400, but 400 actually does come up a lot. 10,
I did.
10 is a big one. 10 commandments, 10 plagues. So, and you know, some of these numbers, we can sort of, we can imagine why a 10 becomes a big number in Judaism. 10 is a big number in most numerical systems and most cultures. And the reason that that is probably because we have 10 fingers, right? So like is the easy way to count. So some of them are intuitive. Like when you see the number 30, you think, oh, month. I'm seeing, you know, 365 in the, yeah, that's a significant number. And the rabbis thought about that number. But some of the numbers that are important in our tradition don't seem particularly universal. There isn't an obvious reason why we would. In fact, it's not so clear why seven itself is such a huge number of distinction in our tradition. The week, as opposed to the month and the year and the day, is not a natural cycle in the world. So that becomes a number that is. And again, we could have a whole class on seven, but that becomes a number that is distinct in itself because of its placement and context in our tradition from the very start. Okay, I wrote about this week, and I'm sort of like you've noticed I'm using this class as a way to also promote my weekly essay for Hadar, and I wrote this piece this week on Parsha Tazria about. These sorts of numbers, because Parsha Tazria opens with a whole slew of numbers, some of which are familiar to us and some of which are very unfamiliar to us. So if you want my valiant attempt at decoding the numbers in Parsha Tazria, take a look at this essay here afterwards. But let's take a look at the numbers themselves and see what it was that I was dealing with. And as I said, in this class, we're going to drill down on one of the numbers, in particular, the number 8. So let's just take a look here. Now I'm going to give you, hold on, I should give you also the source sheet. So let me do that. Source sheet for today. And as I'm doing that, let me say one other thing, which is that there is actually, I just suggested one method for reading numbers, so to speak, that is interpreting the symbolic meaning of numbers. And one method for doing that is to ask, well, are these numbers in the natural world that would occur, you know, to any human being or observer of nature? That's one way of doing it. The other, and maybe the most classic way of reading numbers in this tradition is the system of gematria. Gematria, which you can hear, has a kind of Greek sound, and I think it is related to geometry or geometric something. I'm not sure, maybe someone knows. But gematria is the system by which every Hebrew letter has a numerical value. And in fact, before we used, what are they called? Not Roman numerals, but Arabic numerals. I forget what they're called. Someone knows. Before we used those number symbols, we used letters. Aleph was 1 and Bet was 2, and on through the alphabet. And what that means is that every letter has a numerical value and every word has a numerical value. And so that's a really like juicy way to derive significance from numbers, is just to say, oh, well, this number, the number 18, what does the number 18 represent? Life, because of Chai, because of Chet Yud, And Yud is 10 and Chet is 8. So that's the gematria, what they say, the gematria of life, Chai. And so that's like a classic, especially in the mystical tradition. And God's name is the number 26. And the word for heart is the number 32. And it's, you know, playing with all kinds of, that's a classic system of Jewish numerology. But the one that I want to, having named those two approaches, the approach I want to take today is the approach we usually take in this class, which is to try to situate the number in the discourse of the Torah, and to try to understand how this number recurs in the Torah. So when we say 40, we're not just thinking about the number 40, we're thinking about, oh, well, there were 40 days and 40 nights of the flood, and there were 40 days and 40 nights of Moses being on Mount Sinai. That must mean something. And let's think about what those two contexts or those two cases mean. Okay, you're probably familiar with that general approach that I take. So I want to do that with the number 8 today. And the number 8 is famous in our tradition in some ways, most of all, because of its particular context here, but we'll soon zoom out. So yes, Noah just typed Brit Milah, and that is correct. Did I put the source sheet in the, I don't think I did that yet. Let me put that in. Okay, so let's look at the first source here. This is how Parshat Tazria opens up. And Parshat Tazria opens up with birth. That's its first topic. And then it's got all, there's a very strange birth ritual. Again, I tried to make some sense of it, but even what I wrote this week doesn't make sense of all of it. There's all kinds of things going on here, purity and impurity and periods of time, and especially the distinction between male and female children, which has a whole different set of numbers. And that's very hard to understand. But one of the ways that we might understand that is to say, oh, well, one of the numbers that's different for male and female children is that male children are circumcised and we don't circumcise female children. So that starts to account for some of the differences, but let's read them here. Here, sorry. Here we are. Okay. The Magic Eight. Okay. So this is the beginning of our Parsha Tazria. God spoke to Moshe saying, speak to the Israelite people. Isha ki Tazria. When a woman, Tazria, conceives, this is a very difficult word to translate. I actually ended up translating it as germinates because it's related to the word for seed. But in plain translation, when a woman conceives and bears a male, she shall be impure 7 days, meaning she can't come near the temple for 7 days. To make an offering. And then at the end of that, of her period of impurity, she will make an offering. She shall be impure as at the time of her condition of menstrual separation. There are impurities for all kinds of bodily fluids, including menstrual blood. So that this parallels that time unit. And here's the time unit that we're going to be thinking about today. On the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Okay, that's the Brit Milah. That's the circumcision. It's a central ritual in our tradition, and we'll say more about it in a second. But let's just see the rest of the numbers, just so that you appreciate the sort of slew of seemingly random numbers that we get here. Especially the seven we know, and 8 actually we've seen before as well. We'll talk about that in a second. But then she shall remain in a state of blood purification. That's also a confusing term. For 33 days, she shall not touch any consecrated thing nor enter the sanctuary until her period of purification is completed. And if she bears a female, she shall be impure 2 weeks, that is 14 days, as during her menstruation, and she shall remain in a state of blood purification for 66 days. Now, what the heck is going on there? Well, folks, I figured it all out for you in the essay that I put in the chat. I hope I figured it out, or at least I made some attempt at figuring it out, all those numbers. But right now, I just want to think about the eighth day of circumcision, and I want to ask a basic question, which is why? Why is it on the 8th day? Why is it on the 8th day? And this is not like something that we can answer just by looking in this passage and the difference between male and female birth rituals? No, because circumcision is one of the few commandments that we got all the way back in Genesis. Abraham was first given the commandment to circumcise his all the males in his house. And all of those males were, you know, older than 8 days old. He has circumcised himself. He circumcised his son Ishmael. He circumcised all of the men who were in his household. And then he was told, and every male that is born, you will circumcise on the eighth day. That is already part of the message. So it's like there's something about circumcision that is meant to be on the eighth day. Now, why is that? Anyone want to just like, let's just start with that. Do we have any strong sense of why eight would be significant? If it was a child circumcised on the seventh day, circumcised a child on the seventh, that makes sense. That's like, and now the child is completely formed like the world itself. And on the seventh day, we consecrate that with a circumcision. Like, we can, by the way, circumcise on Shabbat. So that's not the problem. What do you think? Any thoughts? Hal, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it's maybe parallel to creation and Shabbat, you know, that the day of circumcision is a kind of, I don't know, rest, a marker. I mean, you know, it's
the day after Shabbat.
Oh, but it's the day after. Excuse me.
You can't circumcise on Shabbat.
Right, right.
You can circumcise on Shabbat.
Yeah.
Well, never mind. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Hannah. Hannah, you out there? All right, let's move to Noah.
Yeah, on the 8 days, it's really like Al and Kathy were saying, like the 7 plus 1 for the week and the day, and eight's just significant because it's multiples of eight that are in the following numbers, or multiples of 8 plus 1, 2, or 3 that are in Tazria, and eight sections, I believe, or maybe it was 6 sections of the Mishnah and 8 was something else, but there's all sorts of things with 8 that are in Achad Miyodeya.
Okay, all right. All right, so Noah sort of like spreads out a bunch of possibilities for us. And one of those, I think probably the most intuitive one, and I thought Hal was going there, but Hal retracted. But I actually thought that Hal was onto something in saying what I also started to say, which is, oh, well, it's next to 7. And 7 is the most important number in Judaism, right? Besides maybe 1, right? Like 1 God. But other than that, 7's as classic, as resonant a number as you can find. So surely it must have something to do with being the day after the seventh day. Surely there's something about, oh, if creation is for 6 days and rest and reflection is the seventh day, then maybe you needed that cycle to get to the eighth day. Maybe there's some. So what comes after rest and reflection? I mean, that might be one way of thinking about it. Like there's a full cycle. So the eighth represents the beginning of a new cycle, or maybe like another day of rest. Great. So we're certainly going to do that kind of thinking. The proximity to 7 will matter to us. But let's hear a couple of more answers before we start doing some comparative work. Robin, what do you think?
I mean, doesn't this have something to do with the health of the child? And maybe we throw in 7. We get through the week. 7 is the most important number, but I mean, I imagine there was a lot of mortality at birth. And so maybe we're waiting until a full week to do this very, you know, brutal ritual. So maybe that's it.
Okay. I'm so glad that I'm so grateful. I'm like obviously trying to seduce you all into coming up with symbolic connections, but somebody reminds us that maybe there's a very practical reason here. Robin says, look, you're going to cut into the skin of a child. You can't do that on the first day. Like, give it a break. Let it go a week. Let it just be a week. And then, okay, fine. I mean, that's pretty soon as it is. So yeah, that's that would be a more kind of not shot, like literal, but practical, reasonable way of understanding this commitment. Let's try Hannah again.
Yeah, I put it in the notes, but we're from many years ago when I trained as a birth doula, we were taught that the body's natural painkiller, and I don't remember what it is, some opiate situation, kicks in on day 8. We're not the first people to be scientists and observe. Generations would have observed that there was a change in someone's, you know, response to things on day 8. Really practical. A great natural killer. And not everybody has seen a Brit Mila where the baby does not cry. It's possible. It's not necessarily, it depends on many factors, but
yeah, I've seen one of those. It's like, who is this miracle baby? Like, okay. So Hannah in a way takes us back to one of the other approaches we named at the outset, which is to say, maybe we just don't understand. We don't have the full context, but either the Torah in divine wisdom is tuning into the natural world, and there actually something happens on the eighth day. It's what makes sense, or the Torah is a record of human wisdom and records something that people knew then, which was that the eighth day was significant. So that would be a way of, I'm not validating or denying that. I'm just saying you might, and I say this because what Hannah just did is what Maimonides often does, is to say, well, no, we don't understand. But if you follow the biology, the science, there's actually a very kosher laws are there, says Maimonides, because it's known that it's unhealthy for the body. Now, that's a particular approach to try to read the Torah into the natural world. And others would say, no, kosher laws are just what God said. So, okay, so that's a potential approach. Let me, before we get too carried away here, just riffing on 8, which I'm very happy to do. I hope you can tell that I enjoy this kind of work. But I want to employ some of the methods that we often use in this class. And that is in particular to notice repetition of phrases or key words in the Torah. And in this case, there is a very strong echo when we read the phrase Uviyom Hashmini, and on the eighth day, Uviyom Hashmini, on the eighth day, that word Shmini should at this point in the Torah in particular have a very strong resonance for us, right? I'm always trying to get us to train ourselves to listen for echoes in the Torah. But Shmini at this point in the Torah has a very strong echo. Why? Why does Shmini have a very strong echo?
We just read Parshat Shmini.
Good. Yeah. I there are some questions where I don't call on people because it's such, but if someone will come in, then they get the bonus point. So thank you. I think that was Yonatan's voice. That's right. We just read Parshat Shmini last week. Parshat Shmini, that word means the eighth. The eighth. Why was that Parsha called the eighth? Well, something also happened on the eighth day just last week. So it feels to me it's no coincidence that there's a Uviyom Hashmini here when we had a whole parsha named Shmi. And I say no coincidence because we've already had the circumcision laws back in Genesis. We don't need them here. They feel a little bit like an interruption. And really, this is about the birthing mother and all of her rituals. Why is circumcision in there? So there is a kind of an echo that you can't help but hear to the beginning of last week's parsha. So let's take a look at that, where we again have a very prominent eighth day. I'm just going to back up. This is actually 2 weeks ago, the parsha ended like this. And what were we talking about? We were talking about the construction and the actual setting up of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, And they're about to get ready to inaugurate, to begin the procedures of offering sacrifices, to inaugurate the Mishkan. And in preparation, God tells them meaning Moshe, Aaron, and Aaron's sons, you shall not go outside the entrance of the tent of meeting for 7 days. So you just stay with God for 7 days until the day that your period of ordination is completed. Okay, so just note, there's a seven here, okay? And that shouldn't surprise us, but it's another seven that will lead into eight. So that is distinct. Everything done today, God has commanded to be done to make expiation for you. You shall remain at the entrance of the tent of meeting day and night for 7 days, keeping God's charge that you may not die, for so I have been commanded. That's, I guess, Moshe talking to Aaron. And Aaron and his sons did all the things that Hashem had commanded through Moshe. Okay, that's the end of Parshat, I guess it would be Tzav. And then Parshat Shmini begins this way. On the eighth day, Bayom HaShmini, Moses called Aaron and his son and the elders of Israel, and he said to Aaron, and this begins we spent time thinking about these offerings last week, the calf and the goats, and why are they offering these things? These are the first offerings ever offered, the first sacrifices ever offered by the people of Israel in the system that will become the temple sacrifices. Okay, so that's the context, but for our purposes, we're just trying to focus on this one line here, which took that it was so prominent that it became the name of last week's parsha, the eighth day. And then just the next week's parsha, we have 7 days and then the eighth day. So you know how I read the Torah. To me, that's like, that's begging to be interpreted. What is the connection there? If only in the just structural parallels, the seven that culminates in the eight. But now the eighth is not the circumcision. Now the eighth is the day of inauguration of the tabernacle, of the sacrifices. And it is the day, let me just put one more thing up here. It is the day that God says, down here, for today I will appear to you. Ki ayom Hashem nireh aleichem, nireh aleichem. That's pretty significant. So let's just do some of the work we often do in this class. What does the circumcision have to do with the tabernacle? Why the eighth day for the kid and the eighth day for the sacrifice? What parallels do you see there? Okay. Now, this is really something to process here. I mean, there's a lot here. First of all, there's the general, when you hear the Maharal quoted on Hanukkah, it's always eight represents above nature. Eight represents above nature. That is his basic symbolism. Eight, there's seven is the nature, eight is above nature. But what he says about it is sort of startling. It's not above nature because it's nature plus. It's actually, in a sense, it's nature minus. Like, we talk about repairing the world, but what he's saying is it's not necessarily that we add to the world that's the language he uses. Nature is missing something and we have to fix it. But the way we fix it is actually by taking something away. So I'm not sure that would be true for every eight that the Maharal identifies, but it's certainly true for the most prominent one, that eight represents some level above nature, which sounds beautiful, except in order to get to that level, you actually have to take something away from nature. And that's a kind of symbolism that, well, I want to hear what your thoughts, because that's hard for me to make sense of. Let's hear from Ariella. Do you want to? Yeah.
What the circumcision reminds me of is the klipot, the separation, with the sfirot, that there is something separate from.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Ariella comes in hot with some Kabbalah for us all. And that's exactly right. What a brilliant connection. So let me just explain what Ariella is saying in very kind of cryptic language here. Klipot are, the words she used are husks, klipot. And this is a huge term in Kabbalah, in in especially the Kabbalah of the Arizal. It becomes like a very big term. And there's an idea that that the light of the world, the holiness of the world, the essence of the world, that mostly in like projected in the form of light, it's covered over with klipot, with things that are hiding the light. Because a big part of Jewish mystical thinking is that God is everywhere and yet God is hidden. So we have to discover it. And the language that they use, and it's actually very strange language. Why are they so obsessed with husks? Like it's very kernels of grain language. That's they love this metaphor that everything, there's grain everywhere, there's nutrients everywhere, there's light everywhere, but it's covered in husks. And so you have to get rid of the klipot. And I think this is what do you do when you somebody knows, like with wheat, do you shuck or do you shell? You like get rid of the husks. And I obviously have spent all my life in a Beit Midrash and know nothing. But that's the idea, is that you have to reveal the light and you have to reveal God's holiness by getting rid of the dross, the klipot, that which obscures. And in Kabbalistic discourse, the klipot then become like the evil forces, the bad forces, the things that are blocking you from the light. So anyway, that's like a footnote, all of which to explain Ariella's very brilliant connection here, because that's part of it. I think the Maharal would agree completely. The foreskin is like it's like a husk. It's like an occlusion that is, it's blocking. And, you know, in some literal way, you might see it as blocking, you know, the function of this thing. I mean, not really. Obviously, people function with a foreskin. But there's some, the symbolism is that the world, the natural order is beautiful, but not perfect. And it needs a tikkun. It needs adjustment. I guess I'm also just wondering, what do you think of that concept that the world needs fixing at all? I mean, it's now become so popular in our vernacular, Jewish vernacular, that we say, oh, fixing the world, fixing the world, fixing the world. Usually that means doing good deeds, making the world a better place. But in the Maharal's formulation, it means the world is not perfect as it is, and it needs a tweaking. And in this case, what it needs is an untweaking, a kind of removal of something. Okay, let's hear from Kathy.
Okay, so what I'm really struck with here is this notion of the 7 days of whatever it is, creation, and then you come to this kind of point at which, like you say, there's a kind of completion, or there's this, anyway, it's a kind of a turning point. And I think all these, you know, it can be very sort of this very kind of beautiful image of this completion and a super, you know, spirituality or whatever. But it also seems to me that this is also in the context of purification. Like, why is it that we need purification at this point? And it reminds me of this great essay by Rachel Adler on the need for purification at these nexus points between life and death. So it's sort of like when you reach that point, that kind of turning point, and say there isn't a death or there is a death, you know, you need to recognize just the danger of that point. It's this purity and danger, you know, the
Mary Douglas, right?
Yeah. Sort of idea. And so I think that's, you know, clearly the birth of a child is a nexus point between life and death. And reaching the eighth day is a kind of nexus point. And then this whole section of Tazria is about, you know, the purification of the mother, you know, at these kinds of nexus points. So I just wanted to introduce that. I don't think it contradicts the other views, but it kind of adds to it that, you know, you can have completion and you can also have death.
Yeah. Okay. That's very, very helpful. First of all, just bringing us back into the context of the birth rituals themselves, and they're not just an abstraction of numbers. There's all kinds of things happening there that have values attached to them. We're talking about purity and impurity, or at least states of being, death and life and blood. You know, like, let's really think about what's happening here and what is being marked, what kind of ritual is being marked, a new life, but also a danger and a potential death, and the proximity of life to death in these sorts of rituals. I think, honestly, I appreciate you saying all of that, Kathy. I think I avoided that in part because just as a man, I'm like a little bit hesitant to like assign all of the meaning to these rituals that will be performed by women. So I sort of focused on the numbers. But I want to just say that there's an incredible connection that your comments are pushing us toward, which is another circumcision moment in the Torah, where Moses is called back to Egypt, and he's writing, and on the way, it's a very strange scene in Exodus. An angel of God comes and tries to kill them. It's not clear, but seems to kill their child, Gershom, and Zipporah, Moses' wife, runs in and cuts the baby's foreskin, and then the angel retreats. Now, again, that would need a whole class to process, but your comments remind me of that. Like, circumcision in that moment seems to be the thing. It's like there is some occlusion, and it's the thing that saves the baby, as if the baby is hanging in the balance between life and death. I don't know how, like, you know, we have 7 minutes to this class, and I wish we had eight. And we had 7 minutes to this class, and I we won't be able to unpack all of that. But Kathy's comments are really pointing us to some of the really bigger themes and the high stakes and the values that are there, that are present before us whenever we're thinking about these birth or death rituals. And again, birth and death being things that are often hovering in the balance together. Okay, let's hear from Leah.
I want to go back to klipot or husks. I live in a rice culture. Grain needs to be husked in order for the nutrition to be available to us. The husks are not useless, but in order for us to be completely available to the divine and for the divine to be available to us, we need to have that outer shell removed like a rice husk. It's how we take in the spiritual nutrition.
There's a really important sort of spiritual reflection point here, and Leah's doing a good job of articulating it for us, or bringing us there. This idea that Maharal has put out that Ariella built on with the klipot, this idea that maybe our fixing the world, sure, but fixing ourselves. Like, you know, we do inner spiritual work. We come to Yom Kippur, and we might think, I often think when I think about myself and what's lacking, I think about the things I don't have. I'm not as strong or smart or good looking as I, you know, it's like, I think about the things I want to add to myself, but there's a different kind of spiritual reflection. Like, what do I need to take away? What is blocking me? What am I holding on to in myself that maybe I would be better off without? Like, what do I need to quote unquote circumcise? And that's like that's a startling question, but also a powerful one in a way. Okay, I think we have time for one or two more comments. Marlene. We can't hear you, Marlene. Unmute.
I've also been thinking about humility in this transition from 7 to 8, and that we can't necessarily be so sure that just because we've created something or we've done something on the 7, which is supposed to be the great number, that we have to be humble about that it might not be so perfect. So it's not just, so the idea that the Torah lifts us up after 7 days or whatever it is we've done, that we've created a child, a relationship, a piece of art, and the artist, you know you're never done, but somebody will say it's perfect. And you know that the notion that you have to be humble in the face of your striving for perfection and know that there's something beyond that, and that would be the 8.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that's right, Marlene, that okay, so first of all, the way Marlene puts it, I find easy to digest. Like, you know, you're not perfect, and you got to strive, and you got to go above and be, you know, and that version of it is a message that makes sense to me. The version of it, just the version of it that emerges from the language of the Maharal is a little more challenging to me, but it's still what Marlene is saying, which is that there does seem to be some notion in our tradition that nature is not enough. And that's challenging for some people. I think I could imagine voices that voices I've heard from parents around circumcision. My baby is born perfect. Why would I have to alter my child? I get that. We are born perfect. Nature, there's something intuitive to imagining that nature gives you exactly things as they should be. The natural order is the right order. There's something that I find very resonant about that. And yet there's something in this scheme, this idea of transcending nature, that suggests that no, maybe nature's not perfect as it is. Maybe we're not perfect as we are. Maybe the world needs an extra level, a push beyond. Maybe that's what humanity is here for, is to add to nature. Unfortunately, humanity is often ruining nature. So I don't think that's the tweak that God is hoping for. But we are here to work the land and to guard it. And maybe we're here to bring something that is, the natural order is this perfect thing that God created, but maybe not perfect. Maybe we're here to make it perfect, or to make it a little more perfect. Okay. This is just beautiful work you've all done today. I've heard just so much brilliant analysis. And I'll just leave you with one last reference point to contemplate. One last big 8 in the Torah is not Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not in the Torah. And for the moment, I'm not interested in Hanukkah, not just because it's not in the Torah, but also because Hanukkah is just 8 days. Whereas every other one we've seen is 7 plus 1. There's another 7 plus 1 in the Torah, and that is Shmini Atzeret. We have a whole holiday, mysterious holiday, that we actually don't even know exactly what it's for. It's called the 8th day. The 8th day of stopping after the, let me just read it to you. It's a holiday. I've done a whole class on this before, because the holiday itself doesn't seem to have a lot of meaning. We don't know why we have it. But what I want us to do is to think about this holiday now in light of the our conversation we've had about what it is to go from 7 to 8. So the holiday follows Sukkot. Sukkot is 7 days. And here is the holiday. God spoke to Moses saying, say to the Israelite people, on the 15th day of this 7th month, remember the 7 being a big month, shall be the feast of Sukkot to God to last 7 days. The first day shall be a sacred occupation. You shall not work at your occupations. 7 days you shall bring offerings of fire to God. And on the 8th day, same phrase we've been tracking, by Yom Rishon, sorry. I highlighted the wrong one. Here it is. By Yom HaShmini, on the 8th day, it's a nice pazer to emphasize it. Okay. On the 8th day, you shall observe a sacred occasion and bring an offering by fire to God. It is a solemn gathering, and you should not work at your occupations. Okay. So that's that holiday. It's 1 o'clock. We're not going to spend time analyzing it, though we could. But I just want to leave you with that. All of the thinking that we've done should help inform our sense of what that Yom HaShmini is. And yes, it should also inform our sense of what Hanukkah is. And yes, it should also inform our sense of what circumcision is. But in a bigger sense, it should challenge us to think about what it means to live in a natural world and to consider maybe moving one step beyond. You know, what would it mean to transcend nature just one level? What would that take either inside or outside of us? So lots of questions to contemplate as we head into Shabbat. I wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom tomorrow, and I will see you all next week.
Thank you. Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Right? All right. Bye, everyone. Okay, that's it. A taste of our weekly Parsha class. I want to thank everyone who came to the class, some of whose voices you may have heard today, some you didn't because the podcast has been edited. So just want to thank everybody. And speaking of editing, I want to thank also our editor, Vera Blossom, for her great work. If you'd like to join our class sometime and come and join our circle of Torah geeks, you can find us again, Thursdays, 12 p.m., online at ikar.org. That's ikar.org. And if you go to the calendar, then you can find a Zoom link and just click in. And in the section on the website that we keep our classes, you can, if you click on Parsha Study, you'll find all of our archived classes and source sheets and everything we discuss there. So if you're looking for a regular Parsha class, I'd love to see you. And in the meantime, I will talk to you next week.